Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg.
I used to think
And we begin today's program with Rachel Simmons and a book called Enough As She Is, How to Help Girls Move Beyond Impossible Standards of Success to Live Healthy, Happy, and Fulfilling Lives. Rachel Simmons has worked with all kinds of girls and has really worked hard to try to ensure that they find a path towards happiness and fulfillment, going against the grain in terms of what the world tends to set up as impossible and sometimes even ludicrous standards for beauty and other benchmarks of success. Here is our conversation.
I used to think that by helping girls break what I called the curse of the good girl, that they could achieve their potential. I believe that if we could get girls to speak up and advocate for themselves and be less modest and tell people what they were good at, that they could be successful and happy. And to some extent, that's been true. But what I've come to understand, especially in light of all of the depression and the anxiety and the stress that our girls are experiencing, is that what we also need to do is give them the tools to manage all these expectations that they now enjoy and all the opportunities that they enjoy. We need to help them not just lean in, as Sheryl Sandberg has said, but lean inside.
You, through the course of writing this book, interviewed nearly 100 girls to try to get a sense of where they were coming from, the sort of pain or difficulties that they were experiencing in life, along with the joys and so on. I wonder if you could say a word about how it is these particular girls, I think officially maybe 96 in all, who are they? Where did they come from? How hard did you work to make sure it was a diverse array of voices, because I think that is very important in terms of then ultimately what your book tells us.
I did speak to a very diverse group of girls, people who were first-generation college students, who were the first in their families to attend college, people who had grown up with a lot of privilege and for whom it was a foregone conclusion that they would go to college. I interviewed young women who attended a commuter college, a large public university, as well as a small elite women's college, and also girls in high school around the country. So what was so interesting was that it didn't really matter where they came from. If they were ambitious, they were really striving in a way that left so many of them feeling like they were not enough as they were, and that's where the title of the book came from. They often felt they had to be thinner, prettier, smarter, get better grades, get more attention on social media, and that left them with a pervasive sense of self-criticism and anxiety.
I think one of the most interesting examples you give us of this is in the first chapter of the book, where you are talking about that whole stress involved in somebody in high school hoping to go to a really great college or university and what it means to be able to get there. And you tell us that one of the messages that girls are given inadvertently is sort of a message of caution, of make sure that you're using high school to sort of fortify the skills that are already there versus not venturing out, don't make it a time of exploration or experimentation, because that might derail that path towards getting into some elite school which you have dreamed about. And you talk about how that not only can be counterproductive sort of in the moment in terms of those dreams for the next step, but also the way in which that robs a young person of all that a high school education and high school experience, in fact, should include. Explain that further.
Sure. I think it's really quite tragic, actually, the way that so many students believe that they have to stop taking risks. I mean, that's really what we're saying. They have to stop being curious about what they study so that they can put their resume building and their GPA and their test scores above all. And if we think about what it means to be an adolescent, that's a really critical period of time where you should be asking important questions about what you care about and what lights you up. You should also be flexing that muscle of being able to take a risk. I mean, we're talking at the most micro level about raising your hand in class and not being sure if you have the right answer. You know, being able to face a situation where you might not know the outcome, try out for a team and maybe not get accepted, try out for the play and not get a good part. And a lot of these students are foregoing those experiences because they think, I've got to play it safe. I've got to choose the opportunities where I know I'm going to excel. And I find that, again, to be quite tragic when we think about how they are developing at that critical developmental moment of adolescence.
One of the things that's intriguing about your book is that it is a book not just about the difficulties and challenges that face young girls, but also some of the challenges that face parents. You say that there are actually several you call pernicious cultural messages that really sort of strike at the heart of what's already a challenging enough assignment for parents to be good parents to their children. Explain what these pernicious cultural messages are that parents really need to be wary of.
Well, I often say it's, I think, one of the hardest times in history to be a parent, because as a parent myself, I mean, we're just under so much pressure to be excellent at all times. And I think one of the messages that we get is that we have the power to shape our children into who we want them to become. And I think in part that's because of, frankly, people like me who write books on parenting. And we tend to give the suggestion that, oh, just read this book or read this blog. And if you get very well educated about parenting, well, you should be able to kind of produce this amazing child. When in fact, as any parent will tell you, you know, your kid kind of comes out the way they are. So I think that that's an incredibly difficult pressure for us to face, this sense that we're supposed to influence our children in these outsized ways. And then I think we also get this message that our success as parents is judged by the successes or the failures of our children. And again, this really isn't fair, and it puts us as parents in a sense of feeling we are not enough. And so I think what parents also have to do, and I give the book in the book a lot of tools to help parents do this, is we have to learn how to access our own enoughness as parents. We also have to learn how to kind of control our own anxiety, because, my God, it's really hard not to be anxious as we raise our children with these outsized expectations in the culture.
And, of course, that just makes all of this more difficult, of course. And so you say early in the book that you think of yourself first and foremost as an educator. How did that shape the way you approached this topic and especially the writing of this book?
Well, yes, I am a teacher, and I'm a skill builder. I structured this book like a workshop that I teach. I teach workshops at the college campus where I work, and I teach classes, and I really wanted every parent who read this book and every girl to feel like they were getting something out of it, like a lesson that they were taking. And so what I mean by that is that I don't dwell a lot on the problems in the book. I really try to focus on, all right, what are the ingredients or the skills that every girl needs in order to manage some of this? So, for example, one of the things in the book we talk about a lot is overthinking. And this is something we have spoken very little about with our girls, and yet there is an outsized problem of rumination, perseverating. Many girls think, if I think a lot about something, it means I'm closer to solving it, when, in fact, that's absolutely not the case, and it's elevating their anxiety. So the book that has a chapter on rumination and really focuses on, okay, what do you need to do to help your daughter avoid ruminating? What do girls need to do in order to redirect some of that thinking into more productive problem solving? So this book is very much structured like a class I would teach.
Something else that you talk about that is quite intriguing is the notion of role overload, where sometimes girls, and I suppose there are boys who can be prone to this as well, feel like they are taking on multiple roles and find it difficult to sort them all out. How does this typically play out? What kinds of things did you hear about role overload?
Well, I remember reading that phrase when I was doing my research and just having this aha moment, like, yes, that's exactly what girls are dealing with. And so role overload basically means when an individual has too many different roles to play in a single day, and it creates enormous stress. And I think the reason why girls are suffering from this is because when we decided as a society to say to girls, you know what, we're going to give you access to new experiences. We're going to let you go into fields like engineering and, you know, areas where that were previously dominated by boys and men. We didn't then say to girls, you don't have to have that bikini body, or you don't have to be liked by everyone and the good girl. What I think we've said as a society is you need to kind of be all of those old school things that for generations we've wanted you to be, and then you need to take on these new roles. You need to go spend time in the robotics lab. You need to, you know, study in this way and attend these experiences that you've never been given access to. And so it's too much. And it's also what researchers call role conflict, which is when the roles that you're being asked to play are actually in conflict with each other. It's just achieving one role makes it hard to achieve the other.
I think it's really interesting, too, what you say about how some girls find themselves driven to disconnect from certain friends or to pull away from certain friendships that have been important to them. You write at one point that there seem to be new rules of success driving girls to disconnect from their most nourishing relationships. What's going on there? What possible connection could a girl make between their own success and pulling away from friends and friendships that have been very important to them?
Well, it's a couple of things. I mean, one is that when you are trying to be amazing at everything you do, when you hold yourself to a standard that's relatively unattainable, it's very easy to imagine that all of your friends are doing more and being more than you are. And this is something I hear all over the country when I travel and talk to schools and students, is I hear the girls saying, I just have this feeling like everyone's more successful than I am. And so what that creates is a sense of insecurity about friendship, that, you know, I can't necessarily be happy for my friends when they succeed because I'm so concerned that I'm not doing enough as I am. And then I think there's also this belief that, you know, if I have to be amazing, that everyone is potentially a threat on some level, that there's competition. And as I have traveled around the country with this book, the question that girls ask me in the audience is just that. They say to me, what do I do about a friend that I'm jealous of? How do I deal with a friendship where I'm resentful of someone I love because they're succeeding in this way that makes me so insecure? And so I think one of the really terrible casualties of all this pressure and all this striving are the relationships that are so, so nourishing and so important to girls' wellness.
One thing important topic that I sort of grazed is the matter of boys and the fact that boys face their own array of issues and challenges and difficult choices and so on. And your book is, of course, about girls. But more than once, you kind of raise the question of making generalizations about girls feel this and boys feel that. And of course, there is a danger whenever we do that, because there are plenty of girls who tilt the other direction and plenty of boys that tilt the other direction. We aren't all boys who play with trucks and girls who want to be ballet dancers. I mean, we are quite varied, of course, in who we are, and probably nowadays more than ever. In light of that reality, then, how did you go about this? And in a sense, are there lessons in your book that also are worthwhile for boys or the parents of boys to be considering as well? Or does that complicate the picture too much?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I have certainly felt, especially as I've taken this book around the country, so many parents of boys are in my audience, and they say, listen, this is very much about my son. And I don't disagree. I think a great deal of what I talk about, not just in the book, you know, I talk about this in assemblies. I do school assemblies, and there are often lots of boys in the audience, and they are watching me with the same intent and feeling that the girls are. But, and this is a but, we know that in adolescence, there are certain gender differences that intensify. We know that there are certain things that girls are, by researchers' account anyway, said to feel and do somewhat differently. And that's kind of why I wanted to highlight girls. So, for example, I talked a little earlier about rumination, overthinking. We know that girls and women disproportionately do it. We know it's responsible largely for the gender disparity in depression, for the reason why girls and women experience depression at twice the rate of boys and men. We also know that girls have the lowest self-compassion, meaning kindness to the self, of any group of youth. And the list goes on and on. We know girls are less likely to take intellectual risks than boys. So all of these gender differences, which, as you point out, don't make girls qualitatively different from boys, and certainly not every girl experiences that, but to me it pointed to a need, as an educator, as a parent, to give the parents and teachers of girls something that would attend to what we know some of those differences are.
Mm. A last question. Your book, as you've already pointed out, is to give the reader strategies. The other significant thing that you say this book gives the reader is a language. Explain what you mean by that and why you think that is so very, very important.
I'm so glad you asked that, because actually I think that the bottom line most important thing that parents can do is give girls a sense that what they're going through does have a language. And what I mean by that is it's not just something you yourself alone are going through. And that's something that so many teenagers think. So they think, for example, I just can't stop worrying about whether or not this friend is mad at me. But when as a parent you say, hey, listen, that's called rumination. That's a thing. It's a thing that happens to peak at your age. And I want to show you some tools you can use to deal with it. That can be so liberating for the kid who thinks, oh my God, like I couldn't stop thinking about this thing and what's wrong with me. And so for so many of us, knowing that what we're going through isn't our fault or isn't exclusively ours can alleviate shame. It can make you feel more hopeful that, you know, I've got tools, that I'm not alone. And I really believe that when parents do that for teenagers, it can be so powerful and often somewhat simple, so not too hard to do.
The book gives us a whole lot to think about. I really enjoyed it a lot. And it's again titled Enough As She Is, How to Help Girls Move Beyond Impossible Standards of Success to Live Healthy, Happy, and Fulfilling Lives, published by Harper, the author Rachel Simmons. Rachel Simmons, thank you so much. I'm really grateful for this opportunity to speak with you about your fascinating book.
Me too. Thank you.
We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Donald M. Stinson, who is responsible for a disarmingly interesting and entertaining memoir called Downstairs at the White House. Incredibly, Donald Stinson, at the tender age of 17, ended up landing a part-time job of sorts in the White House. And this happened during Watergate, which, of course, is perhaps the single largest political scandal and controversy in American history. And it is not that young Don Stinson was any sort of major player on the political stage at that point, but he was, in a sense, right there as these incredible events were unfolding. And his book about all of those events from so many years ago is so interesting and also really, really entertaining and fun as well. And I really appreciate kind of the self-deprecating tone with which he talks about these memorable experiences, which, of course, he will never forget. The book is published by Eastern Harbor Press. Again, it's titled Downstairs at the White House, The Story of a Teenager, an Oval Office, and a Ringside Seat to Watergate. Donald M. Stimson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Give our listeners just a quick sketch of what you have done in your life professionally since your brief time in the White House.
Well, I spent most of my career in the newspaper business. In fact, at one point I worked for the Milwaukee Journal and Sentinel back in the early 80s. I went into the newspaper business because I found that the government did not offer me a lot of opportunities or to do the kinds of things that I was interested in. And so as soon as I graduated from college, I went into that business. I worked for a number of newspapers around the country. Some people used to say that I couldn't keep a job, but I kept moving up, thankfully, and I retired as senior vice president of Gannett, USA Today, as the head of marketing for the company. Then after that, I went on to open up my own shop as a consultant with a what we call a revenue strategy consulting company about area how to raise revenues without having to add resources. And then I finally got to the point that I decided, you know, I have all of these stories from so many years ago that I have bored a lot of people with. And so now I have not, I might have an opportunity to bore even more and write a book about it.
Very good.
It took about 2 years to put all this together. Luckily, I had notes that I had been at least minimally wise enough to keep over the years, and so I had to reconstruct everything. And it was a lot of fun and a fun project. And thankfully, we've become an Amazon bestseller in political humor and young adult biography and presidents and heads of state.
Hmm. It's a great book, and I enjoyed it Thank even you. More than I thought I would. And one of the things I appreciated, too, is that, you know, one can tell from the cover that it's going to be a book with a lot of humor at it. And yet you, along the way, also speak frankly and seriously and often articulately about the events of the day and the kind of things that you were witnessing and kind of the working parts of the government and your very small little part in it. I just felt like I also learned a lot from your book, aside from the fact of just being thoroughly entertained by it. Maybe you could explain one of the most intriguing lines in the introduction when you say, at the age of 17, I accidentally landed a job at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Explain the accidental nature of this.
Well, first I have to say that a lot of folks over the years have said that there's a lot of Forrest Gump in me. I just kind of stumble into things. And my mother always used to refer to me as an accident waiting to happen. And the short version of a long story is that I was fortunate to sort of stumble into a program that allowed me to go to American University in Washington after my junior year of high school. And that put me in Washington at 17. And you know, back in those days, you could kind of put yourself through college. College expense had not become such an incredible burden. And so I needed a job when I got there in order to, you know, pay a large share of my my tuition and living expenses. So I started looking for a job, and I went to Capitol Hill, and I was a political science and a history major, and I went to Capitol Hill, and nobody there would talk to me. They'd yell at me a lot and tell me to go away, but they really wouldn't talk to me. And one day in many, and I've had many of these kinds of weird things happen in my life, I get talking to a guy who lives in on the same floor in the dormitory. And I mentioned I was looking for a job. He goes, you know, it's interesting. He said, I have a job that I don't really like, and it's got nothing to do with anything I'm studying. If you're interested in it, I'll take you down there. Well, it turned out that he had a job as a clerk and a messenger in a place that I had never heard of called the Old Executive Office Building. And so he took me down, and I interviewed with the group there. It was a staff of an assistant to the president for international economic policy. Of course, I had no idea what international economic policy even was, but I got hired for the job. Now, the part of the kicker in this is that I was so dumb, I didn't realize that I actually worked in the White House complex for the first couple of days. I just thought I was in this building, and despite the fact that I could look out the window and see the White House, somehow in my 17-year-old mind, it didn't even register. I went from, you know, I did important things, like I made copies, and, you know, I delivered mail. But an oddity, yet another oddity, is the fact that I actually had a top-secret security clearance. The FBI actually went out and talked to teachers and other people, including a couple of girls I dated, which was really dicey. And I ended up with a top secret clearance because I was delivering things that were that did have security classifications on them. And one day, first of all, I have to back up to say that the guy that was the assistant to the president was a fascinating guy. He was a descendant of the Bush family of Adolphus Bush and Anheuser-Busch. He had been a fighter pilot in World War II, and among many other distinguished things, he was behind America's adoption of the space shuttle. And brilliant, absolutely wonderful fellow. And so I had a lot of fun there and got to know a lot of people. One of the things that fascinated me was that down the hallway in the old executive office building, and that and the entirety of the White House is all one secure area. In fact, the old executive office building is where most of the White House staff offices are still to this day. It's a very large building in downtown Washington, very old. It was built back in the 1880s. And I was fascinated by the fact that I could see there was an office that, or an office door that had these really, there was a big American flag, and then there was another flag next to it, and over the, there was a seal over the doorway. It was the vice presidential seal, and that's where Vice President Agnew's office was. And so I got interested in that. One day, it was a great curiosity. One day, in yet another accident, I ran into a guy physically in the hallway who was filling up a percolator. If you remember those from the, you may not be as old as I am to remember percolators. But he was filling one up, and I ran into him, spilled water all over him. It was terrible. But the good news was we ended up becoming friends, and he was one of Vice President Agnew's speechwriters. And we got into a conversation, and eventually I ended up getting a job working in the correspondence section there, reading mail that came from everybody from school groups to, I have to say, some different kinds of folks. You find out really that there are a lot of very interesting people who live in the United States, including one guy who used to write it was a five-page letter, like every week, that was entitled Cranberries, America's Silent Hero. There was a family that lived somewhere in the Midwest, not Kenosha or Racine, but somewhere else, that claimed that they had been cranially wired by the Martians. That was the term that they used. And they even sent the vice president. And why sending the vice president, I have no idea, but little tinfoil hats to wear to protect himself from the alien influences. Well, in yet another happenstance, one day, and you know, because I was a kid, and by that time I was 18, and because I was a kid, people dumped on me all the stuff that they didn't want. So one day in the mail came a garbage bag. I didn't even know you could mail such a thing. And they said, hey, Don, that's all yours. So I opened it up, and I looked inside this thing, and it was just weird. There were all these, they were tiny pornographic photos that had been cut out with a pair of electric scissors, a broken pair that was lying in the bag, and some rags in there that looked like they had blood on them. So I immediately panicked and took them right down to the Vice Presidential Protective Division, the Secret Service, and walked in and, you know, presented that to them. Where I thought that was a very big deal to them, it was like it was Tuesday. So they were used to seeing these kinds of crazy things. While I was down there, one of the agents who I had gotten to know said to me, hey, Don, let me introduce you to Mr. Hill. And I said, okay, great. And yeah, I was looking for a cup of coffee or a Danish, or I was always hungry and looking for things. And I meet this guy, and I just shake hands with him and kind of walk off. The agent stops me, and he says, hey, dummy. He goes, that's Clint Hill. And all of a sudden it struck me that that was Agent Clint Hill of the United States Secret Service, who threw himself on the back of JFK's limousine in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And I have to look at it this way. I never met anyone who or knew of anyone who out-heroed Clint Hill. He was an amazing fellow. He's still alive, thank goodness. He's written a number of books. I highly recommend him. Wonderful. Incredible American hero. Oddly enough, yet again, later that week, I happened to have something that I had to take to the West Wing of the White House. I ended up getting on an elevator with the then former Secretary of the Treasury, John Connolly, and ended up having a brief conversation with him. And so in the course of span of, I don't know, you know, 3 or 4 days, whatever it was, I had a I had met two people who had been in that limousine in Dallas on that date, which still makes me shiver a little bit to think about it. It was an incredible experience. Anyway, after Vice President Agnew resigned, and I talked about that, I should say that I tried to make the book, fill it with things that were poignant and then funny and then things that were just weird. And there were a lot of things that were just weird. But one of the more poignant moments was after Vice President Agnew had resigned, we had a party at his house that they threw for all of us before the members of the staff, and there were about 40 or 50 people who were members of the staff between the White House and Capitol Hill before we all went to the Four Winds. And late that night, I kind of hung around to see what was going on, and I ended up sitting on the floor with drinking beer with the guy sitting next to me was Bob Hope's nephew, who was talking about the fact that he and Frank Sinatra were just going to give up a house that they had bought together in Washington, D.C. That was a surrealistic conversation to listen to for a kid from Atlanta. And I was sitting right across from the now former vice president. One of the things that he said that evening was, it was very interesting. He said that he had never wanted to be president. And, of course, back at that time, he was a very highly popular figure in the Republican Party, and was considered to be an odds-on nominee in 1976. So I moved on from that. There are a number of very funny stories about what happened to me in between, because I went over to the department, what was then known as the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and found out that I had to resign in order to get paid, which is a very unusual but very true story. Then again, yet by accident, I ended up with a job in the White House proper, in the East Wing, as a messenger, which was a great job because I had the run of the place, at least certainly the first floor, extending from the East Wing all the way over to anywhere I wanted to go, obviously in the old executive office building. I talk a lot about that in terms of the numerous adventures that I, again, stumbled into. One of the things I used to like to do on Saturdays was I used to like to go into the library on the first floor, which is it's part of the public tours, and I'd sit and do some of my college work at the time until somebody would come along and inevitably throw me out. But I, what I also used to do was to try to loiter in front of the Oval Office, and literally to kind of watch what was going on, because by that time, I moved over into the White House in, I think it was in March of 1974, and of course Watergate was really raging at that time. And so I saw lots of interesting things go on in this. It's a very small area, and but I would kind of, you know, I adopted the idea that if people think you know, if you look like you know what you're doing, you can probably blend in. And so I'd always carry an envelope or something official looking, like I was actually working, when I was actually just kind of looking around at various things. But I had a lot. I also had a lot of fun. I used to eat in the White House kitchen. And get as many. You know, I was a kid. I burned energy like there was no tomorrow. And I would get leftovers from state dinners and things like that. Absolutely fabulous. You find that in the book. I talk a lot about Watergate, and I talk a lot about the people that I met who were associated with the scandal, and some of whom I got to know quite well. And which gives you I have to say that you have at least I had a different view of a lot of things because I knew a lot of the people involved, and I think that tends to shade a lot of different kinds of perceptions that we have of everything in life.
Right.
And one day I had a fun experience with President Nixon. Actually, on one occasion, President Nixon had tried to tell me over the blades of the helicopter that were whirring that I on the South Lawn of Marine One's blades. He was trying to tell me that my shoelaces were untied. I paid no attention to what he was saying. I ended up falling flat on my face. My next close run-in with the president came one morning. What I used to do, I wasn't completely stupid, and what I used to do is I would come in the mornings. I worked full-time, and I went to school full-time. And I would come in through the West Wing, and I would walk to this little cubbyhole I had way down deep in the basement of the East Wing, I would walk through the Rose Garden, an area that people are familiar with on television, and because I could often catch the president as he was walking to the Oval Office in the morning, and then I could say, "Good morning, Mr. President," and that would be my thrill for at least a day, if not longer. And one morning, I was carrying a book with me that had something to do with Theodore Roosevelt on it. And he stopped me. And now I think all he wanted to do was to talk to someone, and I was the closest thing around that had a pulse. But he stopped, and he asked me about the book, and then he began to talk about Theodore Roosevelt. That led into some other comments that he made about Winston Churchill. And I have to say that he was not, at least to me, and at that time, he was not the cardboard character that he was often made out to be. I have never felt the kind of voltage that I felt being around President Nixon at that moment. It was clearly, despite all of the problems of Watergate and everything else, he was clearly a brilliant individual. I've never felt anything like that subsequent to that, including from other presidents. It was very unique kind of thing. But I did, you know, then so that was a more poignant moment. Then there were other silly things, like I mistook Mrs. Nixon one day for a maid, and got into a lot of trouble for what I said about that, and thankfully, actually, Mrs. Nixon bailed me out, or I would have lost my job.
Yeah, I think we've established that the book is a nice mix of kind of the comedic and the serious, and it's a blend that I really like. I want to ask you, you took a job in the executive branch as a young person, and it was a Republican administration. Explain your own affiliation or party loyalty at that point in time? Were you a tried and true Republican and or conservative? And you touch on the fact briefly that you felt at odds with a whole lot of the student population, for instance, at American University, where you were a student. Just where did you fall on the political spectrum, and what difference did that make in terms of what your experience was like within the White House?
Well, I was probably more of a Democrat. I had grown up around in Democratic circles. I'm not even sure I knew too many Republicans before I ended up working there. But I was more of a Southern Democrat back in those days, which then meant that you had somewhat more conservative views about things. So the issue of Vietnam and how we got out of it was something that I had some disagreements with my fellow students about, the realities of trying to move a 500,000 troops back to the United States and equipment and everything else, and sort of a different I had a different view of that. What I found very interesting in all of it is that I had the benefit of being able to work around a lot of people who were very, not only brilliant, but rational thinkers, who actually didn't really have tight party affiliations. You know, that's something that's really come about more in the last 10 to 15 years than it existed at that time. There were lots of people who were Democrats who were political appointees who were there. Pat Moynihan, among one of the more famous ones. Because I think that the issue was more about what do you do that's good for the United States as opposed to what you would do for a particular party, whether it was Republican or Democrat. But I often felt at odds with the people that I went to school with, because a lot of them had a perception that the world was a much easier place than what I was learning about every day in the White House, just by watching what went on and being able to occasionally listen to conversations that made the world a much more complex and difficult place than, you know, most of my friends and many of my professors like to believe.
Hmm. I want to make sure to give you a chance to explain some of what you say about Vice President Spiro Agnew. This is one of the parts in the book that in some ways surprised me just a little bit, only because nowadays when people read about Spiro Agnew, if one reads about him at all or sees him mentioned at all, it tends to be in only the most negative of terms. I mean, I suppose there are some diehard admirers of Spiro Agnew out there, as there were at the time. But by and large, he was someone who was pretty much vilified for a number of different reasons. You speak about Vice President Agnew with some affection, and also, I think, have some regrets about the way in which he was treated and some of the leaking of information that occurred not long before he ultimately resigned. Can you just clarify your attitudes about Vice President Spiro Agnew?
Sure. Well, again, it kind of goes to the issue of, if you get to know people to some degree, although I did not know him very well, he did know me, and he knew that I was in college, and he would ask me what I was studying, and we would from time to time have some conversations. So my view of him was more of, you know, I'm looking at this as an 18-year-old, and I look at this, and this is the Vice President of the United States, and the fact that he'd even talk to me was something that endeared him to me right off the bat. Secondly, I had gotten to know Mrs. Agnew, who was an absolutely lovely lady, and one of their daughters who had actually come down to volunteer to help us push out mail at responses to people when things had really gotten very difficult. I think that he was the victim of a large number of leaks that came out of the Justice Department. I think that he also created some of that situation for himself. What he did was clearly wrong. It was morally wrong. It was the fact that he was actually taking what were, although they were viewed as kind of the way of doing business in Maryland when he had been governor there. I mean, he was taking payoffs when he was vice president of the United States. But I think that what happened is that the Justice Department, people in the Justice Department were all too glad to be able to spread it, share information of the Washington Post and the Star and to the networks that undercut his case. And I think that from a legal standpoint, I think that became a substantial problem, not only in it as a matter of law, but also obviously in the court of public opinion. But at least to me, he was a very nice man. And so I viewed a lot of these people not in the way that they had been presented as sort of cardboard figures. They were as multidimensional as anybody. And he was very nice. I mean, there were, people like John Ehrlichman, who I would run into from time to time. He was another individual who was vilified, but, who yet also wrote some very interesting things about his experiences and clearly recognized that the things that he had done were wrong. So I think it has to do with whether you get to know somebody or not.
Right. A last quick question. One of my favorite stories in the book comes towards the very, very end when you tell a story. At this point in time, Nixon has resigned. It is now the presidency of Gerald Ford. And it is not long after that an interesting envelope arrives at the messenger's office, and your name is on it. And I should think that this moment is among the most memorable in your time working in Washington. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, again, that was just another weird bounce. A lot of the guys that I work with, they knew that I was a college student and that I was very interested in history. And apparently there was someone that lived in the Midwest who, what had happened is they had mailed in a book, and it had come through the Postal Service. It wasn't registered, nothing. I guess they just put stamps on it and went into the mail stream. It was simply addressed to the president, the White House. That was it. Somebody opened it up, looked at it, and said, oh, probably Don would be interested in this. And it went from somewhere in the mailroom to my desk in this little cubby hole in the East Wing. So I opened the thing up, and this book was clearly it was very old, and I opened it up. And there was something that gave me incredible chills. It had, in, as I can best recall, in chronological order, the autographs of some of the most famous individuals in American history. It started somewhere around John Quincy Adams. Davy Crockett's signature was in it, Kit Carson. It was unbelievable, and went all the way through Nixon, and this individual had sent it in for President Ford to sign. After looking at it, running my finger very gently over Abraham Lincoln's signature, which is sure to give at least a history nut like me shivers, I took it and gave it to one of President Ford's secretaries for him to sign. That was last I saw of it. But I've always been interested in what happened, and so I have several theories of where this may have come from. From some different families who have their own interesting stories about how they may have acquired all of these autographs, ranging from families who had connections to presidents to the possibility that it was a White House doorman who actually was collecting every one of these signatures. But it was the most extraordinary thing. One of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen.
Well, your book is chock full of great stories and intriguing insights. And again, it's titled Downstairs at the White House. It is published by Eastern Harbor Press, available from Amazon. And the author, Donald M. Stinson. Donald Stinson, you've done a really, really great job of telling great, great stories about your memorable time working in Washington, D.C., and I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thanks a lot, and best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg.